discussing Price of Chai Yisrael yesterday, and the first topic we were discussing was the purchase of Ma'aretz HaMachpelah, and the fact that the Medrash tells us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu knew there would be three parts of Eretz Yisrael that the Umos HaOlam would contest more than any other part, and that's Hebron, the Har Habayis, and Shechem. And that is why HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted our ownership to be established not by divine promise only, but by an actual purchase. And that is why it is recorded that Avram purchased Hebron, Yaakov bought Shechem, and David HaMelech purchased the Har Habayis from Aravna HaYebusim. If you think about it, these are areas of Arab unrest and hotbed. You know, Shechem was destroyed. That's the Kibbutz Yosef. And the Har Habayis, of course, is still contested, and it's largely occupied by the Arabs. And Hebron, of course, is the same. It's the same problem, that the Medrash actually was carried out in real life. Now, I just want to jump for a moment to the end of the parsha. It's a short parsha. The end of the parsha is after Sarah dies, Avram takes a wife, and her name is Keturah. And Rashi brings the Medrash. It is a machlokas, that Keturah is not another woman, but Keturah is in fact Hagar, that after Sarah died, Avraham remarried Hagar, even though he had sent her away. And this is also connected with the idea that Yishmael himself did tshuva, and as a result, there was no reason not to take Hagar back. And the reason why she goes by the other name of Keturah is connected to the word Ketores. Na'im ma'aseha ke'ketores. Her deeds were as pleasant as incense that is burning. So it turns out that Avram had a very nice circle to his life, meaning to say he lost Sarah, but she was 127. And Hagar comes back, Ishmael comes back, Yitzchak, he has Yitzchak, right? So everything kind of turns into a great, great bracha. But Avram then has children from Keturah. He has 8 sons from Keturah. And so according to that, they're Yishmael's full brothers, because, right, Hagar and Avram. Midian is one of them. In fact, if you look at them, the most familiar one is Midian, and that is the progenitor of the nation of Midian, the Midianites, which are not one of the 7 nations who lived in Canaan, but they lived somewhere else. Unfortunately, they were the ones who hired, well, that depends. Who hired Balak? It was really, who hired Bilam, the combination of Midian and Moab? They both hired. Now, here is the thing. It says that Abraham gave these children gifts, and he sent them to the east. Meaning to say, Eretz Yisrael was exclusively the property of Yitzchak to be passed down to Yaakov. The B'nai Keturah were sent to the east. And Rashi brings another medrash that's very enigmatic, that what are the gifts that Abraham gave to the B'nai Keturah? So the simple meaning would be whatever, money, property. Rashi says no. He gave them what is called Shem Tuma. Shem Tuma literally means powers of impurity. What are powers of impurity? First of all, why would Avram have powers of impurity, and why would he give them away as opposed to destroying them or whatever it would be? So someone who understands that the notion of the B'nai Keturah being sent to the east means they eventually migrated to the Orient, to China, to India, and the like. And the Shem Tuma means Avram had given them various disciplines of wisdom and insight into divinity, which are called Tuma, because not because they were Tuma when he gave them to them, but they became Tuma because they got infiltrated with idolatry later. Which means, in other words, that the spirituality of Eastern religions, let's say Buddhism and the like, is actually a heritage of what Avraham gave to the B'nai Keturah. Right? So it's not enough that Judaism claims to be the origin of all Western religions. We also claim to be the origin of all Eastern religions too. We already got Christianity and Islam, that's for sure. And now we also have Buddhism and Confucianism and everything else. By the way, we also claim Shakespeare, but okay, that's an old. No, because Jews were expelled from England before Shakespeare was even born, but there is some evidence, and again, I'm not going to say it's a big proven case, that Shakespeare was an English Marana, that Shakespeare was actually a hidden Jew who was living in England at the time. In fact, there are one who goes through all the plays. I once saw somebody, a person I knew, a scholar, went through this, could find various hidden references to Gemaras and Midrashim and the like in Shakespeare's plays. But okay. So the thing is, so this is one idea, and this might be why, this might be in some indirect way why so many Jews, unfortunately, are attracted to Eastern religions, because not knowing what Judaism is, not knowing, there is something in those Eastern religions that does come from Avraham Avinu as well, some genuine chokhmah, some genuine wisdom. It got mixed in, smished with Avodah Zarah over the years, but in its core, there are some genuinely valuable ideas. Yeah.
So this would align with the idea that even that there are like, I don't know how to describe it, like dark forces, even in powers of Tumah, that would still be a lot like around today.
Well, yes, because remember that at the source of these Tumah does lie some spark of holiness. And therefore, that kind of gives even the Tumah a certain light. You know, there is a statistic, I don't want to talk about it too much, but there's a statistic that 90% of the English-speaking practitioners of Buddhism are Jewish. They're people who try to convert to Judaism, from Judaism, which is very unfortunate. But on the other hand, one could also see that there's an attraction in their soul to the teaching of Avraham. Now, another thing I want to bring is the Gemara in Sanhedrin. We know in the Torah who was commanded to have bris milah. We know Avraham was commanded. Yishmael was commanded. And then Avraham was commanded that all of his children and descendants should always practice the mitzvah of bris milah. Now, Yishmael had his bris at the age of 13, because Yishmael was born, thank you, Yishmael was born when Avraham was 86, and Avraham had his bris at 99, Yishmael had his bris at 13. When Yitzchak was born the next year, Yitzchak was the first one that had his bris 8 days old. Now, the Gemara in Sanhedrin says that the chiyuv of milah is not only on the children of Yishmael, the chiyuv of bris milah is even on the children of Keturah. B'nei Keturah are chayav in bris milah. Now, there's a machlokes Rashi and the Rambam what that Gemara means. According to Rashi, it's a very limited halacha that has no relevance today. It simply means that those 8 boys had to be circumcised, the same way Yishmael had to be circumcised. But the Torah does not say the children of Yishmael have to be circumcised. In other words, even though Islam traces circumcision to the fact that Yishmael was circumcised, under halacha, that's not true. Under halacha, it is only Yishmael that has a chiyuv of bris, or had a chiyuv of bris. B'nei Yishmael not. And Rashi says that's identical with Keturah. It's only the B'nei Keturah that have a chiyuv bris milah and not the descendants. Now you may ask, well, what's the logic of that after all? Didn't Hashem tell Avram that all of your children have to have a bris milah? The answer is that the Torah says that although Yishmael and B'nai Keturah are biologically Avraham's children, but spiritually it is only from Yitzchak, because that is the meaning of the verse, Ki bi Yitzchak yikare lecha zara, your seed shall be proclaimed via Yitzchak. In fact, it's interesting, the Gemara goes further and says, is Esav considered to be a child of Avraham? No. Or a grandson of Avram, because it says ki bu Yitzchak, through Yitzchak, that means part of Yitzchak. Part of Yitzchak, below kol Yitzchak. It's interesting. In the Rosh Hashanah davening, we have in Musaf Malchios, kingship, Zichronos, remembrance, and shofros. And we blow shofar after each bracha in the Musaf. So the end of the bracha of Zichronos says the following. We ask Hashem, Akedas Yitzchak Lizaro Hayom Barachamim Tiskor. We ask Hashem, please Hashem, remember the Akedah of Yitzchak Lizaro, to his seed. So if you look in a machzor, you will see that there are two gersois in that line. Some machzorim have, or at least they have in parentheses, remember the Akeda of Yitzchak Lizaro Shel Yaakov, to the children of Yaakov. You don't want to say, remember the Akeda of Yitzchak to all of Yitzchak's children, because one of Yitzchak's children was Esav. So we don't want to say, remember the Akeda to all of Yitzchak's children, because that would include Esav. So to get around wishing our enemies a bracha, the Gersa is, Akedas Yitzchak Lizaro Shel Yaakov. See, that's the idea. The other Gersa, however, says, since HaKadosh Baruch Hu did say that Avraham's seed would only be part of Yitzchak, in other words, not all of Yitzchak, so in effect, Esav is already excluded. Although, that's a weak argument, actually. Because Esav is excluded in his relationship to Avraham. He's not excluded in his relationship to Yitzchak. The drasha is, Avraham's seed is part of Yitzchak. So that means Yishmael is excluded, and Esav is excluded from the children of Avraham. But Esav is not excluded, linguistically, from being a child of Yitzchak. So actually, the first Gersa makes a lot of sense. Lazarus Shel Yaakov, okay. They're different Yishchais. But be it as it may, therefore, according to Rashi, the Chiyuv of Bris Milah is only on Yitzchak and his descendants, excluding Esav as well, and on Yishmael himself and on the Bnei Keturah themselves. The Rambam, however, learns the Gemara totally differently. The Rambam learns there is a Chiyuv Dioraisa Ledoros, that the descendants of Bnei Keturah must have Bris Milah. The Midianites, etc., they have Bris Milah. Now, whether they kept this or not, that's another matter, but it's an additional, they're Goyim, but superimposed on the seven Mitzvot Bnei Noach, this segment of eight nations was Mechuyav in the Mitzvah of Bris Milah. Now, one could ask Akasha on the Rambam logically, well, wait a second here, why are the descendants of Bnei Keturah Chayav and Mila, but the Yishmaelites are not Chayav and Mila? In other words, they're both identical parentage, Avram and Hagar. In other words, you're telling me that some of the descendants are considered to be connected to Avram and some of the descendants are not. The answer, I guess, would be, probably, although we don't necessarily have a reason that the Rambam gives, is that since the Bnei Keturah were born after Hagar did Shuvah, so they are spiritually on a higher level that need a Bris Milah as opposed to Yishmael who was born before. Now, the Rambam then says a very surprising halacha, which all the Akharinim ask on, and I'll just mention the halacha and the question without getting into all of the different answers. The Rambam says, technically, it is only the descendants of Keturah that are Chayav and Milah. The descendants of Yishmael are not Chayav and Mila, right? That's what the Rambam says. But since, over the years, the Bnei Keturah, which were like nomadic desert people, intermarried and interbred with the Bnei Yishmael, so they are no longer recognizable. Every Yishmaelite might potentially be a descendant from Bnei Keturah because of the intermarriage. All of the Bnei Yishmael are Chayav and Bris Mila, not because of their status as Yishmael, but because of the possibility of a mixture with the Bnei Keturah. So therefore, practically, the Rambam does say that Bnei Yishmael are Chayav and Mila, not b'toras v'adai, not because of certainty, but because of a suffek of the taruvos of Bnei Keturah. Now, it's interesting, though, that the Rambam does say that the Chiyuv of Bnei Keturah to have Bris Mila is 8 days old, not Bar Mitzvah, because that was limited to Yishmael. So consequently, the Erev circumcision, the Erev don't wait till 13, but they wait 4, 5, 6. I don't know where they get that from. They don't wait. See, I don't understand, because there's either 8 days or there's 13. Those are the two ages that the Torah gives you. They do something in the middle. I'm sure they have some explanation, but I'm not aware. They actually don't. It's a misconception that people think that Islamic is at 13. It commonly is not, but it's also not at 8 days either. So I'll try to check check into that. Be it as it may, therefore, the Rambam does say that practically, the Torah obligates B'nai Yishmael to have a bris mila at the age of 8 days because of the mixture with B'nai Keturah. Now, the question is that it seems fairly clear that there are more Yishmaelites than B'nai Keturah, because Keturah was a smaller nation. And if that's the case, if we're in doubt whether somebody's a Yishmaelite or a Keturahite, then we should follow the rule of majority. And why would they be mechuyev, right? So that's a question that they ask on the Rambam. So instead of saying every Ben Yishmael has to do Bris Mila, we can ask the other way around. None of them should do Bris Mila, because we assume they're from the majority. Especially since we have a principle that when Sancheirav exiled the 10 tribes, he transposed populations from all over the place. So that's why nobody is a definite Yishmael, nobody except for the Jewish people, which we kept our identity. But no nation, there's no Ammonites, there's no Moabites, there's no anything, because everything got mixed in. If so, people were drawn from all over the world, or at least all over Europe and Asia. So wouldn't the principle of Rove actually tell me they're not B'nai Keturah? Okay, so that's a kash in the Rambam, and I just wanted to mention this. Now, going back to another thought, Avraham buys this grave for Sarah, Maras HaMachpelah, because Avraham understood the holiness of it. This was the place of Adam and Chava, etc. Later it became Avram Sarah, Yitzchak Rivka, Yaakov and Leah. Rachel was not buried there. But the Pasuk says, Avram came to Hebron. What does it say? Lispaid es Sarah, to eulogize Sarah, velibchosa, and to cry for Sarah. So the Torah describes two things, besides buying the grave, two things that Avram did to express his grief, express his mourning. One is hespet, eulogy, and the other is bechi, crying. So the Netziv points out a beautiful thought, a very, very, very significant thought. He says, usually, the sequence is the other way around. When a person first is hit with the shock of death of a loved one, they often cry. And then only later they're able to compose their thoughts and do a eulogy. So the sequence of normal mourning is first there is bechia, and then there is hesped. And yet with Avram, we are told, there first was the hesped, and then there was the bechi. So the Netziv says, that is because there are two types of crying that one has. One is simply the emotional pain. Now, the emotional pain is the first thing that hits you. But the other is, when you truly understand spiritually what that person was, the crying you have afterwards is not simply the crying of the emotional pain, but it's the crying that comes from a deep realization of the significance of loss. So that is what we call the crying that comes after hesped. Hesped is an attempt to understand the loss, a gadol leaves you, whatever it would be, to understand what this person represented in the world, and I internalize their teachings. And then when there's a bechi, it is not simply an emotional outburst, but it comes from a true recognition of what the person is, and that comes after hesped. The Gemara in Brachos, maybe you learned this, you learned Brachos. If you remember in the seventh parak of Brachos, it talks about the halachos of Zimun. When three people eat together, they have to bench together. So the Gemara records, it's a famous Gemara, because it's a story that is said at many Hispedim, that after when Rav died, and the Talmidim buried him, and they all ripped their garments, because Rav was their Rebbe who taught them most of their Torah, and a Rebbe who taught you most of your wisdom is like your father, that you actually rip Kriya. I know if you notice, if you were at Rav Avadya's Levaya, there were quite a number of people who were not related, and their garments, their shirt, and their jacket were ripped, because he was considered to be their father in that sense. So they're walking back from the funeral, and they stopped at the bank of a river to eat bread. And they were unsure if that made them a group. Was that enough of a regular sitting down that they constitute a group for Zeman or not. And one of them kind of thought without thinking, you know, oh, we have to ask Rav this Shaila. But then it hits you. Rav's not around anymore. And they all ripped their garment again. Said, Rav has left us, and we don't even know how to bench. They realize how much they needed him. How much, you know, a person might sometimes think, well, I got whatever I could from my Rebbe, you know, that's it. They realized that there were even simple questions, relatively simple questions, for which they didn't have a definitive answer. So they ripped a second time because they recognized what their loss was. That's kind of, after it hits you what the loss is, you rip a second time. That is, libchaisa sarav libchaisa. I'm sorry, lispaita sarav libchaisa. Now, another peculiarity is, in the word libchos, if you look in the Torah and the Chumash as well, there's a small, tiny chaf in the middle. It's not a regular size. It's called a chaf ze'ira. That's Aramaic for a small chaf. And the Sefer Torah has to be written that way. The chaf has to be written in a tiny way. And these are halachah l'moshe m'Sinai. Now, throughout the Torah, there are occasionally letters that are written larger than normal. And there are letters that are written smaller than normal. And these are Hilchos Sefer Torah, Halacha L'Moshe M'Sinai, that a Sefer Torah has to be written this way. And, you know, there are dots, there are all sorts of irregularities, dots over some words, and the like. And if the Torah is not written that way, the Torah is a puzzle. The Torah has to be fixed. One example that you probably know is Shema Yisrael, the famous pasuk in V'Yeschanan. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. So in Shema, the ayin is large, and in Echad, the dalet is large. Now, you've seen that in the Torah. So the significance of that is, that spells the word aid, witness. That when you say Shema, you're giving witness that Hashem is the one and only power in the world. Or others say, at least for the dalet, that the dalet has to be big, because a dalet and a resh look the same when they're relatively small. They're both right? And therefore, if God forbid you would say Hashem Acher, there are other gods, that would be Kfira. So to be sure, like the Torah itself was concerned for nearsighted Bali Kriya, that to be sure that you got it, that it's Echod, the dalet is big. So, but most of the time we don't have an explanation. Vayikra is another example. Hashem calls to Moshe, you know, because the Aleph is small. So there Rashi says that was Moshe's own humility, that Hashem agreed to let him do it small, because Vayikar means God bumped into you. Vayikra, like Bilam, Vayikar. Vayikra means God was looking for you. So Moshe Rabbeinu wanted to express it that God just bumped into him. It wasn't an intentional thing. It was Moshe Rabbeinu's anava. And although Moshe could certainly not change the Torah, but he requested to write it that way. And Hashem says, well, I'm not going to let you skip the Aleph entirely, but you can write it small if you want. But most of the time, we don't really have a reason, and these reasons are not definitive reasons. But it does say a small chaf for lipchaisa. So the Baal HaTurim, just a word about this commentary. So this is a very, very interesting commentary. I don't know if you ever look at it. The Baal HaTurim is none other than the author of the Torah. The Torah is one of the greatest Sifrei Halacha that we have. Rav Yaakov, the author of the Turim, he's called, is the son of the Rush, Rabbeinu Asher. And Rav Yaakov created the organizational structure that Rav Yosef Karo used for the Shulchan Aruch, or Chaim, the four Chalakim, were based on the Torah, which was like 200 years earlier, and the Torah created that structure. And the Torah is still considered to be one of the greatest Sifrei Halacha ever, because unlike the Shulchan Aruch, they only give you a bottom line, the Torah gives you all the Shitas. And then Rav Yosef Karo wrote the Beis Yosef to flesh it out. And the Shulchan Aruch is nothing more than a summary of the Torah and the Beis Yosef brought down the Halacha L'maisa. Now, although the Shulchan Aruch looks very huge, that's because of all the commentaries. Rav Yosef Karo actually wrote the Shulchan Aruch to be completed every 30 days. On the other hand, it's hard for me to imagine this, because I've seen divisions of the Shulchan Aruch into 30 days, just the Shulchan Aruch, without commentaries. And you would have to learn 40 simanim of the Shulchan Aruch every day. That means day one, you do simon, not this is not sif, this is simon, not sif. Simon Aleph to Simon Mem, day one. So it's, I mean, even without a mafarshim, if you could understand it, it's almost impossible. Now, granted, our Shulchan Aruch is Rav Yosef Karo and the Ramah. And the Ramah. So if you take out the Ramah, so you cut it down to 50%. So, but it's still the equivalent. First of all, if you're Ashkenaz, that doesn't make sense because the halacha is like the Ramah. But second of all, so that gets you down to 20 simanim a day. I mean, 20 simanim a day is still a goal that is like totally beyond anything most of us could do, especially if you're going to learn other things. Rav Yosef Kairo wasn't saying this is what you learn the whole day. Kind of, you know, half an hour after davening, you know, do this. So there clearly was a different expectation. But be it as it may, so the Rav Yaakov Bal HaTurim is known for the Torah. That's why he's called Bal HaTurim. But he did write a commentary on Chumash. And the commentary on Chumash has two parts. But only one part is well known, really the less important part. At the beginning of every parsha, he has a few lines about gematrios and roshei tevos and different things which he calls parparos, delicacies. And then he wrote a perish on the Chumash itself. The perish on the Chumash itself, which you can get separately, is not as famous as the parparos, because in virtually every mikros gedolos and some chumashim that don't have other commentaries besides Rashi, they print those little gematrios from the Bal HaTurim, even though they omit the big perish. So if you open up, not every chumash, but many chumash, every mikros gedolos for sure, and even chumashim that don't have other commentaries, you will often see what's called Bal HaTurim, a few lines here and there. And he often says very sharp and incisive gematrios, or how this pasuk is a remez to a certain halacha, or the number of words in this verse equals something, you know, things like that. They're called parparos. So here the Bal HaTurim says a very strange thing. He says, you know why there's a small chav for Sarah? Because he didn't cry too much for her. Because she was a sekena, she was pretty old anyway, 127, and therefore he did not allow himself to cry that much. That's a little strange. Even if it's true, so to speak, why would the Torah record it? Like, what's the significance of emphasizing that point? But I think the simple meaning is that there's a medrash in Kehelas. Kehelas is Shlomo HaMelech's reflections on life we read during Sukkot. And Kehelas' overall tone is very pessimistic. Kehelas is a real depressor. That's all kasha. During Sukkot, why are we reading this book that says that everything is worthless? But one of the verses in Kehelas is, the day of death is better than the day that you're born. And the medrash gives a beautiful mashal why that is so. It says, imagine a ship is leaving the harbor to go trade, going to faraway countries, right? Now, everybody's happy. Ships get great send-offs, you know. We celebrate, we break champagne across the ship and everything else. And yet, we really don't know if that voyage is going to be successful. Perhaps the ship will be lost at sea. It'll be destroyed. There'll be pirates. Perhaps economically it will not be successful. And yet, when the ship comes back, people often don't notice when it comes back. And yet, the opposite ought to be the case. Because when the ship left, there was so much uncertainty. If the ship comes back with success, that ought to be an occasion for rejoicing. It's paradoxical that we make such a big deal when it leaves, and less of a deal when it returns. And he says, life is the same way. Hashem sends a neshama into this world. And when a baby is born, everybody rejoices. Everybody's happy. And yet, in truth, there ought to be some apprehension. Who knows what this child will become? Will he be righteous? Will he be evil? Will he have a good life? Will he have a difficult life? Conversely, when someone dies, that's really returning back to God. Returning, right, after the mission. And we're so sad. But on the other hand, if a person lived a good life and a righteous life, and did mitzvos, in a sense, not that we should be happy, but in a sense there's a completion that they're now ready to get a great and good reward. So it could be the Bal HaTurim is saying that, of course, Avram cried, but Avram had a great joy that in all of her 127 years there was righteousness, there was Kedusha, and therefore What's to cry about? She did her mission. Every day counted. Every day mattered. Every day was good. And that could be a tremendous comfort for a person. Now, I'm not going to say we don't always have that situation, but at least when you have the situation of someone who lived a good and meritorious life, full of kedusha and mitzvahs, that can give a person a great deal of comfort. We're sad. You know, let's say God, like Gedolah maybe are the most obvious examples. Rabbi Yosef was nifter at, was it 102? You know, he was over 100, well over 100. Rabbi Vajra was nifter, you know, at 90, 93. Rav Scheinberg was nifter at 100. Now, Baruch Hashem, these were not people who died as young men. There are people who do die young, and that's especially tragic. These are people who live full lives. In fact, by Rabbi Yosef's age, unfortunately, he was losing quite a few children. And the children weren't necessarily so young either. I mean, he outlived a lot of his children at some point. So it's not that, you know, that's why it's always a little odd to me, as they say, when people say, oy, 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 you know, Rabbi Yosef Zinsher, 102, he says, what is our great sin, you know, that he was taken from us? Well, I mean, okay. I mean, what are they going to say? Let's say he would have lived till 120. You would hear the same thing. You know, it's hard to, you know. So in a sense, though, the loss is our loss. The loss is our loss. It's not that I'm mourning that, you know, he was taken away. But, you know, we don't have his chus in the world. We don't have the ability to learn from him in the world. So we've lost, no matter what. If he would be 200, we would have lost. We lost something very, very great in that way. But in terms of the mace, you can basically say, well, now the mace is Olam Haba. He's with Hashem. All of the goodness that he did, he's now getting rewarded. So we're not sad for the mace. So that could be what the Bava Torim is saying. Yeah. Well, yeah, but in truth, that's okay. In other words, one of the things about Torah is Torah does not deny the need for human emotion, unlike Buddhism. Buddhism basically says you got to cultivate an attitude that all suffering is an illusion, and you just have to not let it bother you. The Torah says that we do accept everything is from Hashem, and we accept it, but the Torah gives us an avenue to suffer and feel sad. The Torah doesn't just say, hey, you don't have a right to feel sad at this moment. So yeah, mourning to some degree is to give a person an out. You know, I remember a case years ago. It was an intermarriage. A Jewish man married a non-Jewish woman. They had a child. The child converted. You know, so the child was Jewish. The child tragically died. The man and the woman were divorced at that point. The child tragically died. And the man, who was part of a religious synagogue, came with so many people from the community to give him support. And I remember the woman like came all by herself. She didn't have that support. There was no shiva to sit. And people have remarked over and over again that the idea of shiva, where the avel is at home and people come to the avel and they try to comfort him and empathize and share burden together, is an enormously therapeutic institution. So yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with saying that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us the laws of Avelus in order to give us a way to express our grief and our sadness and then go on in life. You have to go on. So here I just want to mention a halachic pshat. Again, it's as a pshat in the Chumash, it's really very far-fetched, but it's worthwhile to mention because it teaches you some interesting halachas that one might know. As I had mentioned, that according to Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, which is an early medrash, he says the Akedas Yitzchak actually happened on Yom Kippur. It actually happened on Yom Kippur. And according to that tradition, what is the halacha? And Sarah died. Sarah died the day after Yom Kippur. Sarah died because Sarah got word the next day, and she died after Yom Kippur. So let's look at the halacha here. What is the halacha generally if somebody dies before a Yom Tov? Even if somebody died, let's take an extreme case. Let's say somebody dies Erev Sukkos. Now, Avelus begins with burial, not with death per se, but let's assume the burial was Erev Sukkos. So the halacha is that the coming of a Yom Tov cancels the need for Shiva, as long as Shiva was observed even 5 minutes before a Yom Tov. So it's important to see the difference here. If a burial occurred Erev Sukkos, or Erev Rosh Hashanah for that matter, or Erev Yom Kippur, either one, if it occurred Erev Sukkos, there is no Shiva. By contrast, it's important to know, if a burial occurred on, a burial doesn't occur on Yom Tov, but if a burial occurred on Chol HaMoed, there's no Shiva during Chol HaMoed or Yom Tov, but right after Yom Tov, you have to sit a whole Shiva. See the difference? So, if the burial occurred 1 second before Yom Tov, there is no Shiva. If the burial occurred either on Yom Tov, second day Yom Tov, let's say, or Chol HaMoed, there's going to be a whole Shiva after Yom Tov. Okay. Now, let's say the burial occurred Erev Sukkos. So it cancels Shiva. But how does that work for the Avelus of Shloshim? Because there is a mourning of 30 days if you don't get a haircut and the like. So here the Gemara in Moed Katan says a very unusual thought, a twist in logic that you wouldn't automatically guess. And that is, since the little period of Erev Yom Tov after the burial cancels Shiva, it is equivalent in the counting of Shloshim for 7 days. It's not just that Shiva gets canceled. Rather, it is as if you have 7 days of mourning. Now, Yom Tov and Chol HaMoed also counts for 7 days, because it is 7 days. So, when the burial is Erev Sukkos, by the time you finish Yom Tov, you actually have 14 days towards Shloshim. Then we come to Shemini Atzeres. Shemini Atzeres, halachically, because it is a separate Yom Tov, has the status of another 7 days. So because as a Yom Tov, it's called 7 days, even though it's only 1 day. Right? But it's called a Yom Tov, so just like Yom Tovs are 7 days, because they're 7 days, Shemini Atzeres is 7 days. So it turns out the following. When you bury on Erev Sukkos, even though you've only had 8 days of Shloshim observance, you actually have the equivalent of 21 days, because Erev Yom Tov is 7. You see, Erev Yom Tov is 7. Yom Tov and Chol HaMoed is another 7. Shemini Atzeres is another 7. So you're only Mechuyav after Shemini Atzeres to have 9 more days for Shloshim. So in effect, how long is your Shloshim period? Your Shloshim period is 8 days and 9. It's really 17 days, meaning you've completed your Shloshim in 17 days. Is that correct? 7 days plus a little bit of time on Erev Sukkos, but in terms of whole days, it's 17 days. So some want to say that if Avram buried Sarah Erev Sukkos, based on this cheshbon of Yom Kippur, the reason why there's a small chaf is to be merames that the period of Shloshim was truncated by the coming of these different Yom Tovim. And that's a remez in the Torah to this halacha of Avelus. Okay, now, again, there are other points, so many other points here as well. Let me see what time it is. Let me just mention one other point. The main story of the Parsha, after Avram buys Maris Machpelah, is to find a shidduch for his son Yitzchak. And Yitzchak is very passive in this process. Yitzchak does not go out and look for a wife, because Yitzchak, as a korban, a sanctified korban, is not allowed to leave Eretz Yisrael. So this is Avram's dilemma. Avram, on one hand, does not want his daughter, does not want his son to marry any of the Canaanite women, and even the daughter of Eliezer, who's from Canaan. It has to be Avram's family. But Avram's family is located in Haran, which is northern Mesopotamia. And Yitzchak can't leave, right? So we have this dilemma. Yitzchak can't go there, and Avram doesn't want anybody here, so as a result, he has to send Eliezer. Everybody knows that the guy that he's sending is Eliezer. But it's a funny thing. There are things that we're so sure that are in the Chumash that we would virtually swear they're in the Chumash because we're so sure, but they're actually not in the Chumash at all. If you look in the Chumash, and maybe you notice this, it does not say anywhere. It says his faithful servant. It does not identify that faithful servant as Eliezer. Now, we say contextually, we know from other verses, Eliezer is his servant, etc. But the Chumash doesn't mention his name. Eliezer is totally anonymous in the entire process. Like our mind fills in the blank, but the text does not give you the name. The Maharshal says there's a very, very significant idea here, how faithful Eliezer was. Because remember, Eliezer actually wanted his own daughter to marry Yitzchak. But Avram basically said no. So in a sense, Eliezer had every incentive to sabotage the mission. Because let's say Eliezer came back to Avram, and Eliezer said, remember, Eliezer even mentioned, what if the girl doesn't want to come? So shall I take your son there? And Avram says, under no circumstances, take my son there. So what is the message Eliezer gets? Gee, if she refuses to come, maybe I get a second chance. Because Yitzchak has to marry somebody. So in a sense, Eliezer could have manipulated things that things wouldn't work out. Then he'd report back to Avram, and maybe his daughter would be in the running. And yet, in spite of the fact that this is so painful to Eliezer, Eliezer goes out of his way. I'll talk about tomorrow in Beis Medrash exactly the different ways he did this, but he went out of his way beyond the mission to ensure the success of this shidduch. In other words, he obliterated his own personal agenda. And that is why he is referred to exclusively as Eved Avram, because he was acting exclusively as Avram's alter ego, with no mixture of his own desire. The servant, the anonymous servant, par excellence. That's how devoted he was to Avram Avinu. Even though he was such a righteous person, Avram didn't want him for whatever the reason. Now, I just want to say very briefly, because some of you, maybe all of you, are in the shidduch business already. So let me share with you a beautiful thought from the Ran, the Drushas Haran. This is the same Ran that's in the back of the Gemaras, the Drushas Haran. And that is, he asks this very simple question. And that is, why isn't Eliezer right? Eliezer is a righteous disciple of Avram. Avram's family are idolaters, pagans. Why is Avram saying, go to my Ovdei Avodah Zarah and find a wife? Why shouldn't Avram want to choose the Maimon Bashem, the Tzaddik? So the Drushas Haran says, it is true that Avram's family, at this point, were Ovdei Avodah Zarah. Rivka was not raised in a Beis Yaakov home. Maybe they even had an iPhone, although probably even Lovin was not that evil. You know. But the one thing Avram knew about his family, he knew they had kindness and compassion in their hearts. And the Canaanim had cruelty. Now, granted, we're not saying, the Ran is not saying Eliezer was cruel. Eliezer presumably worked on his midah and became righteous. But Beteva, the Canaanites were Achzorian. And Avram is concerned that if in your nature there is cruelty, that even if you've worked on yourself, that may be passed down to your children. So here's what the Ran says. This is an amazing thing that most Rabban perhaps wouldn't tell you, as I'm just quoting it to the Ran. It says, better to take someone from a house of Avodah Zarah that has kindness and rachamim than to take the most religious person who doesn't have kindness and rachamim. Because an Ovid Avodah Zarah can be educated. An Ovid Avodah Zarah can learn and change. But when someone is cruel, it's much more difficult to change. And that is how Eliezer knew what to do, because who told Eliezer to devise this particular test, the water? It's not superstition. It's not like the first woman that wears a red dress, whatever it is. It's a test that shows kindness. Well, how did Eliezer know that that was the quality he should be looking for? The answer is very pleasant, because that is exactly why Avraham is sending him back to Avraham's family. See? So this is a very important insight. Now, again, I'm not saying that you should take it to that extreme of saying looking, but it does indicate that what you look for, and I assume the woman would look for this, a similar thing, but what a man should look for, certainly, is this quality of kindness, care, and concern. And, you know, there are ways of noticing this, you know, sometimes in strange contexts, you know, how does she, and of course, this is what you're looking at, but keep in mind, you're being watched as well. How does she talk to waiters? Now, if something is not perfect, is it, take away the soup, you know, it's cold? Or is there kind of a recognition that people are working and people are trying to do their best? Right? These are things to look at. These are little things. But these are very, very important things. As the Ran says, the most important element of building a bias is there be a lev tov, a good heart, and a heart of rachamim. And the formal dressings of frumkeit are, you know, I'm not saying they're not important, but they are less important than this basic quality. So some just the word to the wise, this is the Ran. The Ran is very wise, and one should look to the Ran as to what is a good thing to look for. It's the Bezer Hashem. You should all be zeichet to find it.